seeing the man God has sent us. As the banner on the wall, "Enough," subtly suggests, we are in the midst of our stewardship season and theme, and this is the fourth sermon in this Enough series, and by the last sermon next week, I'm sure you'll all be saying, "Enough." Of course, fully understanding what we mean by that, that God provides us enough to do ministry. But this resonates with a book by Reverend Adam Hamilton that we're studying in the Adult Forum, and we'll be wrapping that up next week as well. And this week, you probably have noticed, the pledge letters and cards just went out. Our dedication Sunday is, as we said, November the 11th, and we're hoping to move into 2019 on a strong footing for ministry and for support of our church's outreach, which is significant. Now, none of this should come as a surprise. Seriously, it happens every year at this time, doesn't it? Okay, so we're not surprised. And we're setting the foundation for the ministry of the next year, yes. But even more importantly, this year is truly different because we're setting the foundation for the next several decades of the Presbyterian Church at Shrewsbury, aren't we? We really are setting the context for what's going to happen in our future together. But instead of a stewardship as it relates to money sermon, today I want to first just tell you a story. And this is a story, an account, about a guy named Doug who was a missionary. And Doug, along with his wife, moved to Brazil to a village of the Fulneo Indians in the far reaches of the Amazon. Now, the Indians there, when they first arrived, referred to them, and particularly to him, with a derogatory term. They called him the white man. Because, to be honest, from their experience, other white men through generations had exploited them, had burned their villages, had killed people in their tribes, had robbed their lands. So it was a derogatory term. But these missionaries were different, and they took the trouble living among the people of the village to learn their language, and they began to help them with medicine and in many other ways. And so soon the villagers began calling Doug the good white man. Well, the couple began adopting customs of the people, and the Fulneo spoke of Doug then as the white Indian. It was quite a compliment. And then one day, as Doug was washing the blood-caked, dirty foot of a boy who had been injured, he heard a bystander say to another, "Who ever heard of a white man washing an Indian's foot? Certainly, this man is from God." And from that day on, whenever Doug entered one of the homes, the people would announce, "Here comes the man God sent to us." Now, I've held on to that story for some time, especially for today, because I think it speaks about the true nature of stewardship, which is not about deprivation. Doug did not consider himself to be depriving himself in order to share love and care with these people. He and his wife simply loved them because they loved them. And stewardship is not pity. It is not duty. It's not even basic human generosity, particularly in this context, because these Indians in Brazil would not have equated those motivations with God. They would have thought of them as how people treat each other. The kind of stewardship that these Indians recognized in Doug and his wife was that the love of God had become the currency with which they related themselves to the world and the world to themselves, and how they related themselves to God and related God to themselves and others. So in essence, stewardship is the understanding that a Christian person has of the basic integration of faith and life. Not that we live our lives and then we have faith, but that faith and life need to be totally intertwined. If it is not that basic integration of faith and life, then it is simply not stewardship. So, well, to be honest, I can't give the kind of stewardship sermon that at its conclusion says, God willing, we will make our budget this year. Because I don't think that God makes us meet a budget or not. I think it's our sense of the reality and the meaning and presence of God is what makes us meet a budget. Or our ministry, or our joyful fulfillment of being a Christian community of faith. And accepting that sense of God's presence is, let's admit it, risky business indeed. It is risky emotionally. It is risky socially. It is risky spiritually. And sometimes it's even risky physically. So what is it that makes us take that risk, that leap of faith, to believe that faith in God integrates the often fragmented parts of our lives? How we wish that we had reliable markers to tell us that God really wants this, God really wants that. Well, it's just not that easy in human life to discern the will of the divine. We have to work at it. I remember a favorite Peanuts cartoon. I'm a big fan of Charles Schulz. And in this, Linus, of course, is contemplating, as he often does. And he says to his sister, Lucy, wouldn't it be great to live our lives over again if we knew what we know now? And of course, then Lucy looks off into space. And then she stares back at Linus and she says, what do we know now? Well, you know what? We're like that. Yes, we are. We're like that. We feel that we sense there's a spiritual reality in the universe, that there is a creator God, that there's love and there's purpose that's lodged in a divine will. We know that. But then we say to ourselves, yeah, okay, but I've done church. And what I've experienced is the traditional stuff, the services and the programs and the familiar things, and it's nothing completely out of the ordinary. So based on what I know and have known, I guess that God will not really do anything special in the future. If we could live it over again, would we be any more or any differently committed? Involved, uplifted in our Christian experience? I'd like to think so, but I don't think so. Because like Lucy, we aren't sure what we know now. Based on our hindsight, we don't know much more. If our past doesn't move us to God and with God now, based on what we know, then how would doing it over be any different? Now, I think the truth is we need to be more like Bartimaeus, the blind beggar, than we think. Yeah, think about this. Week after week, you hear preachers proclaim that God is near to us in Jesus Christ, right? And week after week, we then get kind of mired in our problems and oppressed by our inadequacies and depressed by the empty and vacuous values of a society that runs us in circles and yet lets the pieces of life be scattered and fragmented. And then we hear the embracing spirit and life of the living present. Christ can put life together again. Those are two very different messages, aren't they? But we shut ourselves down by saying, well, it hasn't happened yet and it hasn't happened in the past, so it won't happen now. We base our expectations on what we haven't done. Now, Bartimaeus could have reasoned very easily. I've been sitting here for so very long, and Messiahs have come and gone and come and gone. They're always more intrigued with their own power, and they're involved with their crowd of followers that give them power and praise. This Jesus won't care for me any more than the others. That's what I've experienced. So that's what I'm going to expect, and that's how I'm going to act. This Bartimaeus could have sat and stewed. Well, if he really was the Messiah, he would stop and he would take care of me, but he doesn't do it, so he isn't the Messiah. This Bartimaeus could have made God take all the initiative and then blame God when nothing happens. But Bartimaeus, as Billy read to us, Bartimaeus senses God being near, and he casts all caution to the wind, and he cries out in the midst of that crowd, "Son of David, have mercy on me." You notice he didn't say, "Have pity on me." He said, "Have mercy on me." God doesn't offer pity from a distance. God offers mercy, which is grace from an embrace. That's mercy, not pity. Bartimaeus risks being abused by the crowd, ridiculed, pushed away by the disciples. He risks being disappointed. He risks being ignored. He risks being a broken and contrite heart in the arena of arrogant apostles in training. Bartimaeus risks drawing the future into his present instead of letting his past dictate his future. The wonderful Frederick Buechner once reflected on this passage. He said, "The good news breaks into the world where the news has been so bad for so long that when it is good, nobody hears it, except for a few. And who are the few that hear it? They are the ones who labor and are heavy laden, like everybody else, but who, unlike everybody else, know that they labor and are heavy laden. They're the last people you might expect to hear it. They are the broken people, the poor people, the ones who, in terms of the world's wisdom, are children or fools. They are the ones who are willing to believe in miracles because they know it will take a miracle to fill the empty place inside them where grace and peace belong." So the question for us on a stewardship Sunday is, what are we going to do about Jesus Christ being here, right here? You know, it really would be easier for all concerned if Jesus were just an admirable historic prophet, because in that case, we could draw a few conclusions from his teachings. We could apply them with the force of expediency. We could count up our blessings that flow from playing the right percentages. But Jesus is not just a historic figure. He's messed everything up by being present, by being here, by calling to us, by seeing us. He makes it clear that the future is not determined by the past. He offers to make us stewards of life for all the right reasons. And that's where the miracle for Bartimaeus becomes our miracle. From our study on Tuesday, we know that we misread the intention of the gospel writer Mark, because we often interpret this to be just another act of compassion by Jesus to someone in need who happened to be in the right place at the right time. But we also know that Mark's gospel is never, never that simple. It's very concise. It's very direct. Bartimaeus is set before us to be our model for faith. So we need to look at this passage with fresh eyes. Bartimaeus sees who Jesus is more clearly with eyes of faith than those who literally see Jesus. We need to learn to look for Jesus with eyes of faith, rather than just the signs of the times. Bartimaeus risks by calling to Jesus as Son of David. That's a messianic term. Even his disciples, Jesus' disciples, wouldn't even utter those words out in public out of fear. He had no fear. Bartimaeus blurted it out. Bartimaeus put himself in motion. For when he hears that Jesus is calling back to him, it says he gets up and he goes to God instead of waiting for God to come to him. He's in motion. Bartimaeus doesn't debate the theological nuance of whether or not he is culpable for sin or vices or evil, which was what they did in those days. Instead, he doesn't ask for pity. He asks for mercy. He asks for connection. And he states before all of it that he needs God's love and forgiveness. And finally, Bartimaeus is not only healed by Jesus, but after he's healed, Jesus tells him to go with the explanation that his own faith has been instrumental in his healing. Your faith has made you whole. And yet, instead of having pride at what his faith has accomplished, Bartimaeus doesn't go, does he? As we learned on Tuesday, this is the one instance where Jesus heals somebody who actually, then it says, followed him. Somebody who actually followed him. There's a biblical scholar named Halford Luckock who observed this. He said that this episode is a perfect picture of what he calls a headlong response. He says the very words are active words. Think about that passage. Bartimaeus doesn't stop and fold his garment up carefully and leave it and then say to a bystander, "Well, look after this for a moment, I'll be back." No, it says he leaped to his feet and he threw off his cloak. Such headlong response to the words, "He is calling you," is something we greatly need, he writes. We are so careful about springing. We're so cautious about going all out. We like to look before we leap. And so frequently, after a look, we don't leap at all. He says, "Are we so careful of our garments, of our interests of one sort or another, that we fail to have the throb and joy of headlong discipleship?" Do we? We can study trends and learn from them. We can look at the past and make reasoned projections about the future. We can be cautious. We can be lukewarm. We can be safe. Or we can follow Jesus. He acted for faith in the present and then made his future one that went a different pathway than even Jesus would have even thought. And now it's our turn to decide. That's what this campaign is all about. I don't know what the future of PCAS as God's people will be. But I do know that if we choose a cautious, scrape along without a vision pathway, then I can guess. We will become a static church with a steady rate of decline, like so many others. But what if? What if enough of us, not everybody, but just enough of us, decide that Christ is near enough to hear our voices, taking the risk to call out in expectation, "Son of David, have mercy on us. Lead us, guide us." What if we become not stewards of money, but stewards of faith? What if we start looking for Christ with eyes of faith, first of all? What if we start risking the silliness of belief in a world of rationalism? What if we start putting ourselves in motion to God and with God and for God instead of waiting for God to do it for us? What if we admit our brokenness and even our separation from God as being just part of the human condition and that we need the healing of grace. What if we choose to follow Christ in new directions that our traditions and our habits never seemed to allow? I think then the people that know us and meet us will say, here comes the church which sees the man, Jesus, that God sent. And then I think they'll start to say, here comes the church which sees the person God is calling to be the long-term pastor to guide them into God's future. And then eventually I think people will say, here is the church God sends. So friends, I need to say this just because it's stewardship season. If you want to give more money to the church, or a lot more money to the church, great. Woohoo. Give more money. It will be very well used. But if you want to be faithful stewards for God, give all of yourself to God that you have the faith, vision, and courage to give. And this church, which follows Christ, will never be short of money again.